If there's one thing we're all exposed to, it's advertisements. The number of 30-second television commercials seen by the average American child in a year has been estimated at 20,000. At that rate, the average American sees 2 million television commercials in a lifetime. At billboards, newspapers, magazines, mailed flyers, phone solicitations, online advertising, and in-store signage, advertising is ubiquitous. The advertiser's job is to get you to buy something or to vote for someone. Getting you to reason logically isn't part of the job description. If they can sell you something without having you think logically, or by making you think illogically, or not think at all, that's all in a day's work. Philosophers often analyze advertising in terms of logical fallacies. You know a number of those already: ad hominem, false alternative, post hoc ergo propter hoc, appeal to ignorance, hasty generalization. In this lecture, I'll take a different tack. When it comes to advertising, it's often more effective to think in terms of psychological categories. Advertisers use every psychological strategy available. Outwitting the advertiser demands a philosophically critical attitude attuned both to logic and to a range of psychological techniques. I'm going to divide those psychological techniques into two rough categories. The first is a category that relies not on information, not on content, but merely on pushing your buttons. The second category does rely on content and does use information, but that information is used in misleadingly persuasive ways. Let me start with a particular kind of button pushing that I'll call attractiveness attracts. It's been estimated that 25% of men begin balding by age 30, two-thirds by age 60. All in all, 35 million American men are losing their hair. That's about half. Outside of commercials for baldness remedies, how many bald men do you see as spokesmen on television commercials? The Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index indicates that 63% of Americans are either overweight or obese. Outside of weight loss commercials, how many overweight and obese people do you see as spokespeople on television commercials? That's right. The people in television commercials are a strange breed, a different species. They're far more attractive than the average person next door. Why do ads use good-looking people? Because attractiveness attracts. Regardless of the quality of what's being sold, regardless of even what product is being sold, you can bet that an attractive person will be used to sell it. It's your non-rational psychology, rather than your logical rationality, that's being appealed to. Attractiveness is ubiquitous in advertising, and I don't think we can expect that to change. I'm not arguing that advertisers should be forced to pick spokespeople at random, overweight, bald, and all. Of course not. The point's just that to process advertising rationally, we have to be aware of and have to compensate for the fact that attractiveness attracts. In judging whether to buy what a commercial wants us to buy or to vote how a commercial wants us to vote, we need to filter out that aspect of persuasion that relies merely on an irrelevant attractiveness factor. But of course, it's not just the people in advertisements that are at their attractive best. The settings are also pristine. Beer is shown on gorgeous beaches that somehow have no crowds. People in ads speak to you from kitchens that are as clean and spacious as stage sets. That's because they are stage sets. So commercials feature unrealistically attractive people in unrealistically attractive locations. We shouldn't be surprised that they picture the product in the most attractive way as well. Car ads feature single cars gliding through isolated and beautiful surroundings. They're photographed from helicopters, without the sound of helicopters, as they smoothly curve mountain roads, or as they execute a choreographed pirouette on what looks like an enormous airstrip. Never another car in sight. Who wants to buy a car that gets stuck in traffic jams? Guess what? All cars get stuck in traffic jams. I've seen wonderful displays in which people put images from advertisements for fast food next to the most attractive photographs they were able to make of the same item as actually purchased. Advertising images of tidy, well-stuffed tacos next to the peculiarly flat or greasy or partially filled shells you've just paid for. Advertising images of tall super burgers with crisp lettuce, red tomatoes, and attractively melted cheese next to the real sandwich, a little squished and lopsided, the one that actually comes over the counter. Those tomatoes just don't seem to look the same. I invite you to duplicate the experiment yourself next time you go to a fast food restaurant. Look at the image pictured on the overhead menu. Hold up what you purchase and see how representative that image is of what you just bought. In 1970, the Federal Trade Commission settled a complaint against Campbell's Soup, who apparently put marbles in the bottom of the bowl to push the vegetables to the top. Each year, fast food and casual dining chains spend more than $4 billion on television advertising, and it's on the rise. It's not surprising that there's a small industry of specialists working to make food look good in the ads. But what you see may not always be what you think you see. Ice cream melts under the photographic lights, so lard has been used instead. The ice in cold drinks may actually be acrylic. Glue has been used to keep spaghetti on the forks. Off-camera hypodermics to make the sauce drip. Machines under the table to give that appealing waft of steam. All because attractiveness attracts. So here's a thought experiment for you. What would an ad look like that didn't rely on an attractiveness factor? A car ad would show a photograph of the car in a normal environment under normal lighting, with perhaps facts on gas mileage and repair record. A food ad would show a photograph of the hamburger precisely as delivered. Neither of those sounds very attractive, but that's just the point. What you're imagining right now is, in fact, precisely what you're buying. All of the attractiveness you see in commercials above and beyond that isn't appealing to your logic or your rationality. It's just manipulating you psychologically. What I've been emphasizing is the ubiquitous use of attractiveness in advertising. But let me add an exception that proves the rule point as well. Precisely because attractiveness attracts is the standard strategy, some advertising campaigns catch your attention by deliberately flaunting that strategy. Frank Perdue was a bald and scrawny man who reminded people of the chickens he was selling. His very unattractiveness was used to convey sincerity and quality concern. And it worked. Dave Thomas, the man who founded Wendy's, was bashful, soft-spoken, and on the plump side. The fact that he broke the stereotype for attractive spokespeople lent an air of homey honesty to Wendy's commercials. That, I guess, is reverse psychology in terms of attractiveness in advertising. But it's still mere image. The hamburger pictured in the ad may still have only a remote resemblance to what they hand you over the counter. Another form of button pushing is appeal to prestige. European associations tend to carry that prestige. Perrier water and Grey Poupon mustard from France, for example. Or Haagen-Dazs ice cream from... Where exactly is Haagen-Dazs from? Denmark, maybe? Somewhere in Scandinavia? Actually, Haagen-Dazs was founded in the Bronx in 1960 by Polish immigrants Ruben and Rose Mattis. The name Haagen-Dazs was made up to look European to American eyes. Neither a double A with an initial umlaut nor a combination ZS at the end are part of any Scandinavian language. Dutch has a double A, but no umlaut. I'm told that the only European language with a ZS is Hungarian. This is called foreign branding in the marketing industry. Häagen-Dazs is an entirely fictional piece of foreign branding. Indeed, early packaging also included an outline map of Denmark on the label, despite lack of any real association with Denmark. A button-pushing, fallacious appeal to prestige. Fake foreign branding actually ended up in a legal case. There was another foreign-sounding ice cream called Frusengladje. If you leave the accent off that final E, that name actually means something. Frusengladje means frozen delight in Swedish. But despite the fact that the package carried three lines of Swedish, Frusengladje was never sold in Sweden. It was produced, packed by an American company, and distributed entirely within the United States. In 1980, the non-Danish Häagen-Dazs sued the non-Swedish Frusengladje for stealing their trade dress, the general look of a product, which is protected under American law. They lost. The court said there was little chance of confusion between the two. Häagen-Dazs had also claimed that Frusengladje was illegitimately labeling their product as if it were Swedish. The court noted that Häagen-Dazs had equally dirty hands. Attractiveness attracts works not only for products, but for politics. In filming a political ad, you want your candidate to look presidential. You want your candidate seen with a dramatic lighting, a prestigious podium in front, and an American flag in the background. But of course, your candidate is running against someone else. The flip side of attractiveness attracts is that unattractiveness detracts. Political advertisements, television, internet, newspaper, and mass distribution flyers standardly seek out the least attractive image of their opponent that they can find. If you can find an image of your opponent looking annoyed or bewildered or shaking hands with Hitler, you'll use it. You notice that I just switched to speaking of you as the advertiser. And that's not a bad strategy for outwitting the advertiser. You can imagine what you would do if you were just out to push buttons, regardless of content. Because you can imagine what you would do on the sending end, you'll know it when you see it on the receiving end. Appeal to emotion is a classic fallacy. One of the places it shows up in is in political advertising. There, the emotions most often exploited are political pride and fear. If you're filming a political commercial, it'd be great to have an American flag rippling in the breeze. If you pan across amber waves of grain with America the Beautiful rising on the soundtrack, all the better. You note that I haven't said anything about who your candidate is or what your candidate stands for. I've just told you to use emotionally charged patriotic images. Next time you see those, whoever the candidate and whatever the message, remember that what you're seeing is a fallacious appeal to emotion. The other emotion exploited in political advertising is fear. A classic example is the television commercial used by Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater in 1964. It opens with a little girl happily counting petals on a daisy. One, two, three,
four, five, seven, six, eight.
The count then starts in the other direction by a male voiceover.
Six, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Culminating in the flash of a nuclear explosion. Johnson then comes on in voiceover.
To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark, we must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
The implication is that Johnson's opponent, Barry Goldwater of Arizona, is a reckless man ready to pull the nuclear trigger. We've talked about the fallacy of false alternative, and this is another example, but it's also clearly an appeal to emotion, and that emotion is fear. Fear of what will happen if you elect the other guy has probably been used in every political campaign since George Washington. It's a good bet it'll be used in the next one. The fear might be of a terrorist attack, of overcompetition by China, of what will happen if we don't have mandated health insurance, of what will happen if we do, of future generations burdened by our debt, or a future without Social Security. All of those represent issues that should be rashly considered in a political decision, that should be addressed with relevant evidence and careful argument in political debate. The problem is that they almost never are. They're used as hair triggers for fear instead. One way of sensitizing oneself to fallacious advertising is to learn the standard categories. Appeal to emotion is one of those, as is appeal to prestige. But you don't have to know the names. Here's a simple philosophical tool for detecting the kinds of fallacies we've been talking about. Take any advertisement. Read it or listen to it or watch it with care, and then sit down with a piece of paper and write at the top, the reasons given for buying the product were, and list them, 1, 2, 3. Also write, the reasons given for buying this product rather than a competitor were, list those one by one. A rational decision is one based on reasons. Rational means reasonable, and reasonable demands reasons. If you're going to do one thing rather than another, or buy one brand rather than another, or vote for one candidate rather than another, any rational decision is going to be based on reasons. So sit down with any advertisement and try to cash it out in terms of reasons. The reasons given for buying the product were. If the advertisement is relying merely on an attractive image, it may turn out you can find no reasons to list at all. Sometimes you can list reasons, but once examined, it becomes clear that they aren't very good reasons, like, it sounds Swedish. Once you try to cash out standard commercials in terms of reasons, it becomes pretty clear how far from rational their appeal often is. Here's another fallacy common in advertising, the appeal to dubious authority. An instantly recognizable celebrity touts the virtues of the product, recommends it, or says that they use it. What makes an appeal to dubious authority is that you're given no reason to believe that the celebrity knows what they're talking about. Here are some examples. Tiger Woods did a series of commercials touting Buicks. Tiger's a great golfer. He's had some serious marital problems, but we've got no reason to believe he knows much about cars. Johnny Depp does Mont Blanc watches. Good-looking guy, great fun as an actor, but I'm not sure he's an authority on watches. Most of the advertisements we've talked about so far rely on psychological manipulation rather than on claims or statements of fact. Some commercials do make claims, however, either explicitly or by implication. Aren't there laws against false advertising? Indeed, there are. The core piece of federal legislation is the Lanham Act, which prohibits any commercial advertising or promotion that misrepresents the nature, characteristics, qualities, or geographic origin of goods, services, or commercial activities. The Federal Trade Commission is empowered to enforce regulations against unfair and deceptive practices in commerce. The FTC has acted against false and misleading advertising, against marbles in the bottom of the bowl, for example, and against an ad campaign by the California Milk Producers Advisory Board that touted, "Everybody needs milk." Of course, that's not true. Milk is the last thing that the lactose intolerant need. The FTC acted against Amoco Oil for claiming that crystal clear Amoco Ultimate was better for your car and better for the environment because it was clear. Amoco had no evidence to back up those claims. But the result of such action rarely goes beyond an order to pull the ads or to demand corrective advertising. No advertising executive is doing hard time for false advertising. The law also allows consumers and rival companies to pursue civil action. The suit must prove a false statement of fact that could be expected to deceive, must prove that it was likely to affect purchasing decisions, and that the plaintiff suffered injury of some kind. Short of a class action case, that kind of litigation is a tall and expensive order for any consumer. The way most false advertising appears in court is in civil suits by one company against another, like Häagen-Dazs versus Frusenglasche, for example. And of course, the legal restrictions we're talking about extend only to commercial advertising. Political advertising isn't included. You don't need to say something false in order to get someone to believe something false. One way of misleading someone is to tell them the truth, but be careful not to tell them the whole truth. Consider just a few of the phrases that tend to show up in advertising. None proven more effective. That claim's true even if all competing brands have been shown to be equally effective. Indeed, none proven more effective is true if none were proven effective at all. Faster acting, or more effective, or longer lasting than the leading brand. It's not always clear what the leading brand is. It might be true that my product is faster acting than the leading brand, and still be true that it's slower acting than any of the other contenders. Recommended by doctors. It doesn't say recommended by all doctors, or even recommended by most doctors. It just says recommended by doctors. It'd be hard to find a pharmaceutical that wasn't recommended by some doctors. It may be literally true, then, that a product is recommended by doctors, but any implication of general medical consensus is a false implication. You get the idea. If the advertiser can speak a limited truth and get you to make false inferences, he's within the letter of the law and yet still doing a great job of deception. Everything he says may be literally true. What you are led to believe may be false nonetheless. More recently, recommended by doctors has given way to a similar implication carried by something that isn't even a statement. Ask your doctor whether Bonitranq might be right for you. Here's a final category of advertising tricks, the magic word. There are a whole set of magic words that reappear in advertising. Some may not mean what you think they mean. Some may not mean much of anything at all. Consider, for example, foods labeled low fat, reduced fat, light, 98% fat-free, or simply fat-free, low calorie, reduced calorie, lower sodium, light. All of that sounds great, but what do those words mean? When you check the Food and Drug Administration guidelines, some of those terms carry absolute standards. A main dish counts as low fat if it contains less than 3% fat and not more than 30% of its calories come from fat. Some of those terms are relative terms instead. A potato chip can boast of reduced sodium if it has at least 25% less sodium than your standard run-of-the-mill potato chip. The standard's higher for light. You need 50% fewer calories than the standard can of beer to qualify as a light beer. A big proviso for standards like that is that they often have no legal teeth. They're merely non-binding industry recommendations. There's also another problem here. If a product is labeled low fat, that means it contains a certain percentage of fat. It doesn't mean it won't make you fat. A product can be labeled low fat despite the fact that it's packed with calories, sugar, carbohydrates, and salt. Indeed, Twizzlers candy boasts of being a low-fat food. They don't mean it'll keep you low fat. So here again we have selective mention. It may be true that a product has low fat, but that should make you wonder about the other aspects that might be important. Calories, carbohydrates, and salt, for example. The label that says low salt may speak the truth, but what it labels may still be unhealthy in other ways. There's no complete list of magic words to watch out for. Advertisers can be counted on to borrow or invent magic words faster than they can be specified in law or in non-binding industry recommendations. It took the USDA 10 years to settle on a definition for organic. Many of the magic words sound good, but when you stop to ask yourself what they mean, it's not clear that they mean much of anything at all. New, improved, new and improved, original, vitamin enriched, with 6 antioxidants, healthy, economy sized, heart healthy, nutritious, better tasting, longer lasting, home style, all natural, and my favorite, as seen on TV. We certainly haven't exhausted the topic of fallacious advertising. That topic is big enough for a course of its own. What I've tried to do is to give you a feel for two, four major categories of fallacious advertising. One thing to look out for is everything that isn't information, everything that's just out to push your buttons. The other thing to look out for is the misleading use of any information that does appear, to think about what that information really means and what information you're not being given. Now it's your turn. We're going to end by giving you two clips for analysis. These aren't real ads, but they'll work as samples, and you can go on to dissect the real ads on your own. In each case, listen to the ad, pause the tape, and think about it for a minute. I want you to name what's wrong or suspicious about each ad. You could do this in terms of categories, standard categories like appeal to authority, for example, but it'll do just as well to ask just three questions. What psychological buttons are being pushed? What is the precise claim that's being made? And what relevant information may have been left out? If you can do that in each case, you're well on your way to outwitting the advertiser.
You're alone upstairs in the dark. You hear a window break downstairs and the phone being ripped from the wall. Someone is starting up the stairs. They are coming closer to your bedroom door. Closer, closer. You can see the doorknob turn. Don't you wish you had a gun? Gun control? Tell them no on Proposition 12.
What's happening in that ad? If you said they were pushing emotional buttons, you're right. That's a classic appeal to fear. Gun control is a complicated topic, with both facts and important principles at issue. Principles about the right to self-protection, for example, but also statistics on the likelihood of shooting friends or family rather than an intruder. It's a tough issue, worthy of careful and detailed rational discussion, deliberation, and debate. Did the ad address any of that? No, it merely stimulated fear. It dealt with a complex and controversial social issue merely by manipulating your emotions. Okay, we have time for one more. Let's see if you can name the main fallacy committed in this commercial, and at least two other points. Let's see if you can outwit the advertiser.
Hard day at the lab? Do what I do. Energize with ErgoSip. Physicians will tell you that fatigue is a feeling of weariness, tiredness, or lack of energy. Physicists will tell you that energy is the ability to do work. Energy, that's what energy drinks are made for. But did you know that most other energy drinks are mostly water? That's right, water. ErgoSip, made with the finest ingredients. And the taste? Well, there's nothing quite like it. Had a hard day at the lab? Do what I do. Reach for a tall, cold can of ErgoSip.
Okay, what about that one? Some of the finer points. Most other energy drinks are mostly water. That's true enough. The major ingredient in all energy drinks is water. The implication is that ErgoSip is somehow different. But of course, the ad never said that. Made of the finest ingredients. What does that mean? And the taste. Well, there's nothing quite like it. That's true for just about everything. No real information there. The major fallacy here, however, is appeal to dubious authority. It actually appears in two different ways. There's an appeal to the authority of both physicists and physicians. Physicians will tell you that fatigue is a feeling of weariness, tiredness, or lack of energy. Physicists will tell you that energy is the ability to do work. Those are really just definitions in the fields, of course. They aren't talking about ErgoSip. Appeal to dubious authority is built into the whole setup. Test tubes, lab coat, blackboard full of equations. Who is this person? What lab? This has appeal to dubious authority written all over it. In order to outwit the advertiser, you have to see through attractiveness attracts, appeal to prestige, appeal to emotion, appeal to dubious authority, misleading half-truths, and magic words. Learn to see through the spin. Next time we'll talk about spin again, not in advertising, but in putting a spin on statistics.